call our second case of the November calendar, 00-2157, Ronald Schaefer versus Robert Riegelman. And we will hear first from Thomas Boyd, Attorney Boyd, representing Ronald Schaefer.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I am Tom Boyd. I am here on behalf of Appellant Ronald Schaefer. Mr. Schaefer has appealed from the Circuit Court's order granting summary judgment in favor of Appellee Robert Riegelman. The Circuit Court erred in holding that the initial pleading filed in this case failed to comply with Wisconsin Statute Section 802.05. The Court further erred in holding that any defect in the signature divested it of subject matter jurisdiction. Mr. Schaefer respectfully requests the Court to reverse the Circuit Court in this matter and to remand the case for full trial on the merits. The Wisconsin Court of Appeals has certified a particular question to this Court. The Court has asked, does the signature on a complaint by an attorney not admitted to practice law in Wisconsin at the direction and on behalf of an attorney who is admitted to practice law in Wisconsin constitute a fundamental defect sufficient to deprive the trial court of jurisdiction?
Mr. Boyd, I'm just going to interrupt you for a moment since this is an issue in this case. Are you admitted in this state?
Yes, I am. And I'm proud to say I am.
I'm delighted to hear that. May proceed under those circumstances.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I have checked, and I am in current good standing, and I have complied with all my CLEs. Your Honor, the signature on a pleading motion or other paper signed by a licensed attorney at the direction of and on behalf of an attorney who is admitted to practice law does comply with Section
8. Boyd, I'm going to interrupt you once again. We're having a little trouble with our sound system today. So it may be helpful if you would raise the podium. There is a button on your left side. Yes, this is high technology. Good. Well, we'll keep trying, and I don't know how high it goes.
Okay. I'd be happy to step away, too, if that...
No, I don't know what it is, so you better step in. I would speak right into the microphone.
All right. Very well. As I indicated, it's our position that the signature on this complaint, under the circumstances described in the record, fully complies with all the requirements under Section 802.05. As the Court is aware, that statute requires that all papers be subscribed with a handwritten signature of at least one attorney of record in the individual's name. In this case, the pleading in question bears the signatures of two licensed attorneys, Robert R. Weinstein, who is licensed to practice law both in Wisconsin and Minnesota, and who authorized the placement of his handwritten signature on the pleading in his absence. The pleading also contains or bears the handwritten signature of Julie Fischel, who is licensed and in good standing with the state of Minnesota, and also is a member of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and the Western District of Wisconsin. The signatures are handwritten as required under the statute. The signature line was not left blank. The names were not typed in. This was not a situation involving a rubber stamp. The names were not signed by a non-lawyer. The signatures are all in the individual's names, again, in handwritten form.
Now, is your argument relating to the first summons and complaint or the second summons with the attached first complaint, or both?
Both, Your Honor.
Both. So if we were standing here with just the first summons and complaint, your argument would be that Mr. Weinstein authorized the signature. It's his signature. It doesn't matter how it's signed.
Yes, Your Honor.
It would be signed by a stamp.
Well, let me... I said yes too quickly. I do think this is a different situation, distinguishable from a rubber stamp.
Some human being.
Some human being who is an attorney, licensed in good standing, in the same law firm, representing the same client, who was expressly authorized.
Is that in the record? record. If I ask you a question that's not in the record, do not respond, please.
It's my understanding in reviewing the record that the summons and complaint were drafted jointly by Mr. Weinstein and Ms. Fischel. It's my further understanding from the record, from Mr. Weinstein's affidavit in the record, that he reviewed drafts as they went through, commented, and approved the final version of the summons and complaint.
So if it was frivolous, he'd be personally liable, or could be personally liable if there was a sanction, because that's his endorsement that it's not a frivolous action.
That's precisely correct. He did review it, and he did satisfy himself it was not frivolous, that it was well-grounded in the facts, in the law, and not intended for any proper purpose. He did satisfy himself before he authorized the signature, as did Ms. Fischel, who, again, while not admitted pro hac vice at the time the first summons and complaint were executed, was admitted in the courts of Minnesota and the federal courts that include Wisconsin, and she as well satisfied herself that this was not interposed for any improper purpose. It was well grounded in law and fact.
Counsel, I want to test. You're saying generally this is okay in this instance. It's okay that a person not authorized to practice law in the state of Wisconsin signed it, even though the statute requires a person authorized in the state of Wisconsin to sign it. It shall be subscribed with a handwritten signature, da-da-da-da-da, under 80205. But you say, oh, this is okay because an attorney authorized it, and then you also have that they're in the same firm, and the person who did sign it was a lawyer. I'm going to take those three things and test which of those three are important or are they not important. Let's say he didn't authorize it. Let's say he was gone. To Europe for a week with his family on a well-deserved vacation, and all of a sudden, oh my goodness, the statute is going to run. We got to get this thing in. I mean, I know he would want me to file it before we have a huge problem. But no express authorization whatsoever. Is it still okay then?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, if I may just take issue with the preliminary point you made. We are not conceding this was a violation of the statute. His signature was put forth in handwritten form. We believe it complies. Your question, I think, rightly goes to whether or not the person who placed the signature, his handwritten signature on the pleadings, was authorized, whether she felt comfortable doing it or not, whether it was expressly authorized.
Let me take... your additional premise to my question. I'm not sure I totally agree with it, but let me take that as a premise. If he didn't authorize it specifically to have his signature, and I guess that's what we're focusing on, his signature rather than hers?
Well, Your Honor,
focusing on both.
We have arguments about both signatures, Your Honor.
If he did not authorize his signature to be put on it, would you have a problem?
Yes, I would.
If it was authorized, but it was someone that co-counseling in a different firm on the case, would you have a problem?
Still putting their signature, putting Mr. Weinstein's signature on, I would have the same concern. And that is, he has not expressly authorized the handwritten signature to go on the pleading. He can ratify it after the fact, and I think it would be appropriate for whether it's someone in her own firm or someone in a separate firm who's co-counsel.
Okay, let me. I wasn't clear. I'm sorry. It's my fault. Assuming he authorizes, you have three things. He authorized it, they're in the same firm, and it was done by a lawyer. Assuming he authorizes it, but authorizes someone in a different firm to sign the his name. Do you have a problem with that? Oh, counseling. It's in a different firm.
Licensed attorney has, you're talking about a licensed attorney in another firm representing the same party.
But not licensed in the state of Wisconsin.
But not licensed in the same. I would say it's the same situation.
Same situation as what?
As what occurred here, a licensed attorney representing the same party received express authority to place the handwritten signature.
Okay. Final thing is by a lawyer. What if in his firm he authorized the receptionist to sign his name? Does that comport with the requirements of the statute?
Well, that's a different case than our situation, and frankly, I can't tell you for certain, because in that case, he would have provided his express authority. The handwritten signature would be on it, and if there were any further need of ratification or subscription, he could ratify it after the fact. I think our case is more appropriate. Because we do have a licensed attorney who independently satisfied herself under her ethical obligations and under the rules that this was a well-founded complaint. I think the distinction here in your hypothetical would be the receptionist would not have the same obligations. So it would not be...
Is your answer that a receptionist signing it with authority by him to sign his name and file it, he's out of town, it's got to be filed today, that would not meet the requirements of the statute?
It would be my position that that's a less compelling case and it's less clear.
What about a paralegal?
I would say the same thing, although I believe paralegals may have some ethical obligations that they... separately subscribed to, but I think the bright line is the obligations that a lawyer has, in this case a lawyer who has to adhere to the rules of professional responsibility in Minnesota, and also when appearing here in Wisconsin has to adhere to the Wisconsin rules, and separately by putting her name on the signature on the pleading is subjecting herself to the jurisdiction of the court under 802.05, just as in federal court, she would be subjecting herself under Rule 11.
So basically, it's where a code of professional responsibility, vis-a-vis Minnesota or Wisconsin, would be able to be brought in the event of some difficulty. See, that seems to be the distinguishing characteristic that you're making.
I would agree that these lawyers, whether it's Mr. Weinstein who gives his express authority or Ms. Fischel who signs it on her own, in doing so, they are subject to the rules of professional responsibility under both Minnesota and Wisconsin. And further, under 802.05, by writing their name, whether it's by express authority or whether it's directly putting their name with their own hand on the pleading, that in and of themselves, apart from the rules of professional responsibility, subjects them to the rules of conduct before the court.
How do you get around Section 990.01, sub 38?
Of the rules of professional conduct?
Of the Wisconsin statutes.
I'm not aware of it.
That section says that if the signature, and this is in the found in the chapter concerning construction of statutes, sub 38, and it says, if the signature of any person is required by law, it shall always be the handwriting of such person, which clearly seems to preclude authorizing somebody else to sign for you.
Yeah, I apologize for not being as familiar with that section as I would like to be, but I would respectfully say it does not preclude this type of situation. We've provided a discussion of the law of agency in our case, or in our briefs, and certainly a party may authorize another to sign on their behalf. And it does have the legal force and effect under Wisconsin law.
This statute seems to say no. the only exception provided for in this statute is that if the person is unable to write the person's mark or the person's name written by some other person at the person's request and in the person's presence will satisfy, but it's not your contention that Mr. Weinstein was unable to write.
No, Your Honor. He's able to write.
I didn't think you'd argue with that.
He was out of town, and it was urgent and important to provide or to get the complaint filed and served as soon as possible. So we were in a position where he was not available. Again, Your Honor, we have cited the cases arguing the law of agency, and I think those principles are clear. I won't belabor them, but apart from agency, there's also the principle, the contract principle of ratification. And in this case, while if I were to concede, and I'm not quite prepared to concede this, but if I were to concede that this signature on behalf of Mr. Weinstein violated the statute you referred to, he can still ratify it and still put himself within the court's jurisdiction if there are any issues relating to the complaint. I would say, leaving Mr. Weinstein aside, however, the signature of Julie Fischel on the summons and the subsequent amended summons does comply with the statute that you're referring to.
But the subsequent complaint was a photocopy of the original containing the allegedly defective signature. There was no amended complaint filed with a signature meeting this apparent requirement, correct?
It is correct that there was no subsequently, to my knowledge, there was no subsequently filed, re-signed, or amended complaint.
And the statute 80205 authorizing the correction of the defect requires that it be corrected promptly.
And it was in this, case, Your Honor.
The summons was. The complaint was never corrected. Isn't that the factual situation here?
That's correct that that's the factual situation, but what I would focus on is what the cure was. And the cure was when Ms. Fischel promptly moved and obtained admission pro hac vice. And that clearly subjected her to the court's rules and responsibilities. We would respectfully submit there was no need for her to go back and re-sign an amended complaint. By becoming admitted pro hac vice, if there was a defect, she cured it. And in that case, if the purpose of 802.05 is to hold attorneys responsible, which the Gaddis case clearly states, which all the cases dealing with 802.05 state, in this case, this attorney, Ms. Fischel, was held accountable under the rules of the Minnesota Code of Responsibility, the Wisconsin Code of Responsibility. Her obligations under 802.05 and under the pro hac vice admission.
Mr. Boyd, if there was to be a cure, why shouldn't the cure that's required be that Mr. Weinstein should have signed an amended summons or an amended complaint or both, rather than having Ms. Fischel get admitted pro hac vice and then re-sign?
Well, that could have been a cure.
Why isn't that the cure that's expected by the statute, rather than having a person who had signed on behalf of someone else now sign an amended summons?
I think the important point is that the statute doesn't specify what the cure is. The example you provided certainly would be appropriate, but the statute does not limit attorneys, in fact, does not limit the court to a particular type of cure, and I think that goes back to the purpose. The purpose of the statute is to hold lawyers accountable. Accordingly, the statute, in holding attorneys responsible, should be interpreted liberally, rather than providing a shield where attorneys can hide behind a defective signature or a defect of some other sort to avoid the repercussions for improperly filed papers or pleadings. The court and the law should instead read 802.05 liberally and broadly to hold lawyers accountable, whether it's through a subsequently filed complaint that has Mr. Weinstein's signature or Ms. Fischel, or going to the original complaint, and if there was a defect, had been cured by an attorney who came in willingly and sought out admission pro hac vice in these underlying proceedings.
Counsel, I'm mindful that there are several ways you can approach a legal issue, and several start with a certain statute or start another way. And as I was preparing in this case, before I read the briefs, I was reflecting what some of the arguments would be. One argument that came to my mind that you did not advance, and I want to ask you, is it because my argument is infirm? What's wrong with this? And it's this. Under 802.05, it requires that every pleading contain the name, state bar number, and shall be subscribed with the handwritten signature of at least one attorney of record. Well, I look at the pleading, and it was not signed by the attorney who's authorized to practice law in the state of Wisconsin. I saw that in preparing on this case as tantamount to no signature at all, because there were no valid signatures. The person that signed wasn't authorized to practice law. The one that needed to sign didn't sign. So the statute indicates if a pleading is not signed, and I would put, if there are no valid signatures, I mean, an attorney can have their child sign it, but that doesn't mean it's a valid signature, so it's unsigned for purposes of law. If a pleading is not signed, it shall be stricken unless it is signed promptly after the omission is called to the attention of the pleader. Here you had a responsive pleading. The response of pleading to the complaint indicated some problems with the validity of the summons and complaint. The attorney was admitted pro hac vice, and then arguably promptly filed a new summons and complaint. The new one was signed afresh. The complaint was not, yet I see nothing in 802.05 that requires it be a original signature. You know, laws of evidence, by and large, allow for photocopies in virtually anything unless there is a question about the accuracy. I mean, that's pretty well established. So why isn't that the avenue? What's wrong with that avenue?
Well, I may not have followed the argument precisely.
Not have made it precisely.
if you're saying that the fact that it was a copy of the original filed complaint.
I'm saying this. Your signatures amount to no signatures whatsoever. There's a remedy in the statute that says when it's not signed, what do you do? The remedy is if it's signed promptly after it's brought to the attention. If it's cured, the problem is cured. It was signed. You can argue that it was signed promptly. I don't know if you'd prevail on the argument, but it was signed. You've got a problem with the photocopy. There's nothing in the law that requires that it be original signature, and photocopy is well accepted unless there's a problem about authenticity or accuracy. What's wrong with that?
Well, I hate to be dense about this, but if your point is going to whether or not the original signatures could ever have full force and effect as lawful signatures under 802.05 simply because they were not re-signed after the fact, I would again stress that the statute provides an opportunity to cure the signature. In this case, the signatures were already made. pro hac vice admission, which the court had the authority to grant, cures any potential defect that existed with regard to Ms. Fischel's signature, whether it was on the original summons and complaint or the subsequent amended summons that attached the original complaint.
I think, if I may be so bold, I think the point that Justice Bradley might be trying to reach, and what concerned me as well, was that the position of Mr. Johnson seems to be tantamount to saying that it would have been better if there had been no signature on the plane. That your, in other words, what she, I think, may be saying, but I'll put it to you more bluntly, is your position would have been far stronger had the attorneys failed to sign it at all.
And I appreciate that. I certainly apologize for missing that originally. I would vehemently disagree with that position. In this case, what happened allowed the purposes of 802.05 to be served. If no one signs it, then no one is accountable. In this case, two separate attorneys are accountable. Mr. Weinstein is accountable because he expressly authorized it in advance and ratified it after the fact.
Well, I think what I'm saying here is that it seems to me a response to Mr. Johnson's arguments would be what he's arguing, in essence, would lead to the conclusion that we would have been better off because we'd have been okay had we not signed it at all, and that's an absurd result.
It is, Your Honor. It's absurd because it does not advance the purposes of the statute, and it does not provide for anyone to be accountable. And it also does not insist and require for the advance review and satisfaction of the 802.05 obligations. Yes, Your Honor.
I was thinking as I read this case that we're going to have around 60 students from the high schools listening to this. And I was thinking that we might very well have a visitor from some country in the world who's come to observe the great functioning of great judiciaries in this country. I think that we probably recognize this country as having great laws, great judiciary, and great process. And here we are on the Supreme Court of Wisconsin debating signatures. And there's no debate at all that one name who was signed is a qualified lawyer in this state, that the other person who signed with full authority became a qualified lawyer, and you can correct this. And so there's no question that the summons is okay. The question is whether the complaint is okay, and the complaint is attached to the summons, and there's reference in the new summons to that complaint, right? And we're debating whether or not we're going to accept that. Now, we haven't even come near the merits of this case. And here we are, how many years later, right? What kind of system is that? How do we explain that system? That may be rhetorical to you, but I am addressing it to Mr. Johnson.
But
so be prepared.
My time is up. If I may answer
it. You may answer it.
It is a system that is wholly inconsistent with 802.05. 802.05 focuses on making sure attorneys...
perhaps at lunchtime, but if we can't proceed, we may have to do it between your ending and Mr. Johnson beginning. So continue on as best you can for the moment.
Thank you. It is not consistent with the purposes of 802.05, which is to hold attorneys accountable. It also is not consistent with the way statutes in this state are to be applied, which is to go to the underlying purposes, and it's not consistent with the way disputes are to be resolved in the courts of this state, which is to resolve them on the merits rather than on hyper-technicalities. And in this case, where there's no dispute that prompt, proper, complete notice of all the essential information was provided from the very outset, the parties engaged in discovery. Responsive pleadings were served and filed. This case proceeded for 10 or more months and was set to go to trial approximately 1 month after the judge issued the decision to dismiss the case. So in this situation, I would certainly respond to your question by saying this is not the way our system is supposed to work, and this is not the way the statutes were intended to work. Please.
But under the same argument, if this very well-pleaded case, all those correct signatures came in one day late, we have all the good intentions, and our system would then, should we then allow that case to be heard because it's one day late? What I'm saying is there has to be some cutoff, and technical or fundamental.
And that's exactly, that certainly frames the issue in this court. If this court does not agree with me that they were proper signatures to begin with, then the question is, are they technical defects or are they fundamental?
How do you know it's technical and fundamental until the court tells you?
Well, there are some decisions that the court has effectively told us up to this point that I think support the proposition it's technical. The Gaddis case, which I referred to before, the Novak case from the Court of Appeals earlier this year, the Dungan case, all of those I think would draw a distinction between a statute of limitations, which can be substantive and in that case would be, and procedural defects that both under Wisconsin cases I've referred to and under a long line of federal cases dealing with Rule 11 uniformly say those are irregularities that do not go to the jurisdiction of the court, that they can be cured and that they should be overlooked when the cure is prompt. And in our case, the prompt cure was the Pro Hoc Vitae admission.
Thank you, counsel. Much. If we could proceed, I think we try, and then the pair will be made during the recess.
I am a little concerned about what the lawyer from Minnesota might think if the microphone now starts to work properly, but my name is Terry Johnson. I appear here before you for the defendant respondent, Mr. Riegelman. I'm pleased to see that at least on this presentation, the plaintiff's position is a little clearer. If one examines their brief, you will see a lengthy, even one might call it exhaustive, discussion of how they see the merits of this case. The merits of this case were not before the court on the motion. They weren't debated by us, and I want to emphasize, you've only heard their view of the merits. We haven't had a chance to put the merits of the underlying case before you. This case is a case which presents a policy issue which this court has to decide, and I agree with Justice Wilcox and I agree with the Chief Justice that we are, to some extent, and perhaps to the people in the audience here, drawing some fine lines. I don't think we are, and I think it can be far more readily understood why we aren't if one examines what the record does actually say about what happened, because with all due respect to counsel who wasn't involved in the trial court, I believe he inadvertently made some errors in describing what the record says. The record is remarkably sparse, and what is there is not at all helpful to the appellant in terms of the real issue in this case. Because the real issue in this case is not whether someone is subject to sanctions. The real issue in this case is not whether we can take advantage of a technical problem. The real issue is how far will the court allow parties to go in eroding the minimum protection which litigants have in this state against lawsuits being asserted thoughtlessly or frivolously. Because the protection is extremely minimal. All we require that an attorney do is, before filing a complaint, an attorney who is licensed to practice in this state in some way, either because he's licensed generally or he or she is admitted pro hoc vice, review the facts, satisfy himself or herself that there is a factual basis for the claims and a good faith basis for the claims that are being asserted under the law. Reassuring, isn't it? And then sign the complaint. And signing the complaint, as Justice Sykes pointed out, under the statutes means something fairly specific. And in all honesty, we didn't remember to cite that, I don't think. Section 80205 makes it very clear, because a handwritten signature...
Now, there's a preface to the construction. It says, in the construction of Wisconsin law, the words and phrases which follow shall be construed as indicated, unless such construction would produce a result inconsistent with the manifest intent of the legislature. So, you got a, there's a wiggle room in there.
There always is.
That's right. So, I just thought I'd point that out to you.
But the fact that there is wiggle room means doesn't mean we ought to encourage it. And so at risk of going over the facts in too much detail here, I think the development of this factually and what the record shows is important.
Counsel.
Yes.
Do you have any doubt that the fact that the lawyer was admitted pro hoc vici and signed the summons and attached thereto a complaint which has both her name and another Wisconsin lawyer's name, would give you the opportunity to hold them liable for?
Yes.
I have a considerable doubt
on that, yes.
Tell us what your doubt is.
The Kaplan case, which we said in our brief, says specifically that, that you have to have a clear record, and it is not a question. I suggest you're looking at it from the wrong end, Chief Justice. The question here is not sanctions. This system is not about finding ways to punish people for doing wrong. The system is about ways of making sure lawsuits are commenced properly. And that's, when you look at the record in this case, what is clearly missing.
The record indicate that Mr. Weinstein
drafted the
read it and drafted it. You have to stand in front of the
trying to minimize
microphone. Okay.
The record doesn't indicate he drafted it. There's not a word in this affidavit that says he did. It says he reviewed it.
Okay.
Counsel
doesn't
indicated
have to draft it.
Well, you asked to be drafted. Representation okay. was made that he drafted it. Representation was also made that Ms. Fischel reviewed the pleadings. There is nothing in the record which indicates Ms. Fischel reviewed the pleadings. Representation was made that the reason this was done was because it had to be filed then and it was urgent. There is nothing in the record that suggests that at all.
Are we up against the statute of limitations?
And there's no assertion that they were.
If this were dismissed, would there be a statute of limitations issue?
Yes.
Okay.
Smart lawyering. They waited too long because the record shows that they had plenty of opportunity to fix this because there is a cure, and there isn't any doubt about what the cure is. The statute says you sign it.
After the second summons was served, how long after that did you object to the lack of a signature?
We filed an affirmative defense promptly that said the original summons and complaint and the amended summons and complaint were defective. And approximately 7 or 8 months later, in all honesty, after we were reasonably confident the statute had run, we brought a motion for summary judgment because this is an adversary system. And if they weren't following the rules and didn't do the elementary things they could have done to check into this, such as, for example, sending me a half-page interrogatory that said just what in the heck is wrong with the complaint and the amended complaint, I would have had to say the complaint was not signed by Mr. Weinstein. It wasn't signed by Ms. Fischel, because it wasn't signed by Ms. Fischel. A signature is someone purporting to sign a document in her own name. What Ms. Fischel did is no different than if she had typed on it, by the way, Robert Weinstein by Julie Fischel, because she wasn't signing it herself and wasn't claiming to sign it herself. She was merely noting on the document in handwriting that she had signed for Mr. Weinstein. So there's no record before the court that Mr. Weinstein was involved in drafting it. There's no record before the court that Ms. Fischel reviewed the complaint. There's no record before the court as to why Mr. Weinstein was unavailable, whether he was unavailable for 20 minutes, a day, or a week. There's no record before the court as to why it had to be filed then. There's no record before the court as to what Mr. Weinstein means when he says he authorized her to sign it. Does that mean on a blanket basis he told her one day, Julie, if you ever have to sign anything and you think it's okay, just go ahead and I'll back you up? That could have been it. Or he could have talked to her on the phone that day and said, yes, I understand that this might be convenient to file it today, might be necessary to file it today. I remember reviewing it. I will take responsibility under the statute. Sign my name. We don't know any of those things. Ms. Fischel doesn't say anything about being authorized in her affidavit. So everything in this case suggests that the momentary solemnity of someone sitting down and saying, is this being asserted with a good faith factual basis? Should I sign this as an attorney? Not because I'm being exposed to sanctions, but because just as when I filed the answer and I thought, can I assert that there's improper service on the amended summons and complaint? I thought to myself, I think serving someone with a defective complaint might be deemed improper service, so I'll assert that. That minimal amount of professional responsibility, there is no record anyone exercised.
Now, as I understand, there's some dates here that I'm a little bit confused on, and maybe they've been intentionally left out of the briefs. But as I understand it, the lawsuit was commenced on August 17th, 1999, with the filing of the summons and complaint.
I believe that's the correct date.
And then you answered it on September 7th.
Correct. There's one date in between here that I think is important.
Yeah,
on August 31st, I think it is, Ms. Fischel was admitted pro act vice after they had served Mr. Weinstein without, or excuse me, Mr. Riegelman, without any notice to him. It was an ex parte admission pro act vice, which we didn't even know about when we were served with the amended summons complaint. First notice we had of that was when they opposed the motion.
Okay, then on September 7th, you answered it, and this is the first time you brought it to their attention that there was a problem. You brought
right.
it, and then on September 20th, they filed an amended summons and complaint.
Right. Apparently realizing in between there was something wrong.
Now, when did the statute run?
I was afraid someone was going to ask that. I think depending upon how one construes the discovery rule, it was sometime in either very late that year or very early the next year, sometime in the 9 months between the filing of the amended summons complaint and the filing of the motion.
But there's no question then, I take it from the response to my question, there is no question here that after you had given them notices on both September 7th and after their amended complaint, they still had time to correct it.
Before in a variety of ways, such as, for example, going to court and signing the original complaint, which is what the statute says is to be done promptly to cure it.
Yeah.
There are other ways, by filing an additional action, by filing an amended complaint, they could do it. But to literally cure the error, the statute doesn't say cure and say liberally construe that. It says you sign the document.
Counsel, I want to focus on this momentary solemnity that you are emphasizing. One of the cases that you referenced and appropriately did not fully discuss in your brief is the Novak case. The Novak case is now a published opinion, and the Novak case says, well, here you have a summons and complaint, if I recall correctly, that you just have a rubber stamp. You know, the attorney's name is rubber stamped. And the Court of Appeals said, well, that's just a technical error, and then you have to show prejudice. If there's no prejudice, it's just fine and dandy. How do you get around the Novak case with your momentary solemnity argument when the Court of Appeals in Novak says only a technical error, not fundamental, if it's done by a rubber stamp, and then you ask about prejudice?
At risk of sounding flip, I thought one of the virtues of being here was that you could overrule the Court of Appeals. I don't get around it. I say it is a bad decision and you should reject it.
Okay.
For two reasons. I'll tell you the astounding thing in the Novak case. It is implied. Well, I guess, who stamped it? Are we suggesting that the lawyer there with the summons and complaint decided, oh, I guess this time I'll just use my stamp instead of signing it. I'll dig around in my desk and get it out. No, the implication of the Novak case is that the lawyer didn't stamp it, someone else in the office, and to me, since no one bothered to put it in the record, it's pretty obvious some secretary or paralegal or receptionist, as you've hypothecated in earlier questions, rubber stamped it. And I tell you, that is wrong. And the Court of Appeals decision is wrong. We should not allow him to rubber stamp that any more than we allow the rubber stamping of an affidavit.
Okay, let me ask, if it is, if we do not overrule the Novak case, and if we say it is a technical error, has your client been prejudiced by the technical error?
Has my client been prejudiced by the technical error? No, I cannot say my client has been prejudiced by the technical error in the individual. I think you have harmed the process overall, but Mr. Riegelman has not been harmed in the context of this case, other than, of course, it is possible he will lose instead of winning, as we have so far, but that's the risk of the system.
I want to get back for just a moment. So September 7th, you filed the answer and you brought it to their attention. Now let's assume that the lawsuit that was filed, the summons and complaint, bore no signature at all. And then on September 7th, you answered it, and you pointed out that there's no jurisdiction here because there's no...
At risk of interrupting, but only to answer a question which was asked before, this one bore no signature at all. No, the hypothetical is no different.
Well, okay, the point here, and which I'd like you to respond, is that it seems to me that had you pointed it out, that there was no signature, they could have corrected it, because... The statute says if a pleading is not signed, it shall be stricken unless it is signed promptly after the omission is called to the attention of the pleader. So it seems to me that the point that you're making, and I have trouble not concluding that it's somewhat absurd, is that they would have been in a better position had they not signed it at all.
Right? No, they're in the same position. This was not signed. Mr. Weinstein didn't sign it. Ms. Fischel didn't purport to sign it. Ms. Fischel made a notation in her own hand that she wrote Mr. Weinstein's name on the summons and on the complaint.
Okay, well, what is their error here? Waiting too long to sign it, or not signing it at all?
I think the more appropriate question is which of their errors should one focus on. One of their errors is they didn't sign it. Another error is that they didn't determine what was the proper thing to do once they knew or should have known it was defective. And certainly one other error was they waited too long to fix it.
Would we be here if they filed an amended summons and complaint on September 20th? No signature?
To my recollection, not on this issue, no. Because they would have complied with the law and filed a summons and a complaint, presuming they then served it properly on my client, which complied with the statute.
Is it your position that the assertion of the jurisdictional defense as an affirmative defense in the answer was sufficient under the statute to call it to the attention of the opposing party?
Yes.
To trigger the duty to promptly sign?
Yes, and if it wasn't, the motion was. The motion was filed 11 months ago, 11 months before they first suggested in the materials they filed on appeal that they wanted to cure this.
Okay, so if Mr. Weinstein or Ms. Fischel, because at that point she was admitted pro hoc vice, had filed a complaint, a summons and complaint that was signed within the meaning of the statute in response to your motion, would that have constituted a prompt correction?
I don't think so, because I think the answer brought the defect to their attention, and I think the time runs from there, and I think 10 or 11 months later is far too late. If you were to conclude that the first time the defect was brought to their attention was with the motion for summary judgment, if they had done it promptly thereafter, then if there were no other timing problems, I haven't gone back and looked at relation back and issues like that as to whether they would have some problems, because they would be beyond the statute of limitations at that point, clearly, I think. But they certainly would be in better shape than they were today. But it seems to me that the statute says the problem is brought to their attention. I filed two answers. If the first one only said it and the second one didn't, they might have an argument that they believed it had been corrected. If the second one just said the original complaint was defective, they might have an argument it wasn't brought to their attention. But the affirmative defense, the very first affirmative defense in the second, the answer to the purported amended complaint, said the summons and complaint and the amended summons and complaint were both defective. I think they were put on notice of that. And the fact that there were easy ways in which this could have been avoided or corrected doesn't change the fact that it wasn't. Justice Wilcox brought up the statute of limitations. As I recall, there is case law in this state that rather clearly establishes that if I go and file a summons and complaint and get copies authenticated and photocopy the authenticated summons and complaint and serve that, that's not proper service, because the statutes require some minimum assurance that the proper steps have been taken before you've properly commenced the lawsuit. The question really here is, why do we have to erode the protections, the minimal protections my client has, in order to preserve his rights, Mr. Schaefer's alleged rights against my client, when, and it gives me no pleasure to say it, he is not remedy-less. If an error was made and he lost the meritorious claim, unfortunately he has a remedy for that. I don't think this court should adopt cases impliedly, I think, as Justice Bradley pointed out, saying it's okay to, and the term is informative itself, rubber stamp a complaint. Is that really what Section 80205 says we want attorneys to be doing? For Ms. Fischel, for example, to say, well, I think Mr. Weinstein reviewed it, he said it was okay, so I'll just rubber stamp it. Because if you affirm Novak, that's what you'll be saying. I think if you say this is okay, you'll be saying exactly the same thing. That it doesn't matter how bad the process was, it doesn't matter how far you have gone from what we have required, we will validate it to save the cause of action. I don't think saving Mr. Schaefer's cause of action is important enough to erode the public policies that exist, the minimal protection litigants have when they're defendants.
And did you proceed with discovery and proceed under this complaint and answer?
Yes.
Leaving out the statute of limitations?
Yes. And hoping that the time within which we could bring a motion for summary judgment would be sufficiently delayed so that we could bring the motion after we were confident the statute had run.
Is there any time limit on bringing a summary judgment motion?
As I recall, and I'm not sure if it's a matter of record in this case, there commonly is, and as I recall in this case, there was a deadline under the scheduling order for bringing dispositive motions, and this was brought, my guess would be the day before that deadline. I know it was very close to the deadline.
Busy looking for a statute that tolls the statute of limitations when there's an appeal and a reversal or an affirmance.
Well, the statute tolls the statute of limitations by a timely commenced case. So if this case had ever been commenced properly, if this court were to conclude now that this defect is merely technical, that it doesn't matter, that it's not fundamental, then this action would be revived, and even if it wasn't revived, somehow it would have been told for as long as it was pending, and I believe we would not have a statute of limitations defense. The reason the statute has run is because, since this is a fundamental defect, we believe under the law, the trial court concluded it, the time we thought this action was pending didn't toll the statute, and it ran in the interim.
There's a certain line of jurisprudence that deals with relation back, and that is the kind of, you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
That doesn't come into play here?
No, it doesn't, because you have to have a validly commenced action in the first place, I believe, in order to relate back by adding parties or adding claims later. Then they relate back to the commencement of the action, because this is a fundamental defect, because no one signed the summons and complaint with their own handwritten signature under 80205. There is no commencement of this action to relate back.
Indeed, I think of that area of case law that's quite vague in my mind, but it does arise in the kinds of cases where there are statute of limitations problems. Something is filed that's found to be problematic, and then they amend it, and the question is, can it relate, and they amend it after the statute of limitations is run, can it relate back to the original? And I just don't know, I just don't recall.
And my understanding is that requires that the case have been commenced properly as to someone, at least, within the statute. Second of all, I point out to you, the case was dismissed. They never moved to amend the complaint. They never amended the complaint with a properly executed summons and complaint to make the argument that it might relate back. So I'm not sure you're right, Justice Bradley, but if you were, it was another opportunity to fix this, that which is now gone because the action's been dismissed.
You're not taking the position, are you? How's that to start the question? If it would have been signed by an attorney who's admitted to practice law in the state, and that attorney also signed for another attorney admitted to practice law in the state, that's valid. In other words, you're not taking the position that an attorney can't have someone else sign their name. It's just that if that other person signs on their own behalf, they have to be an attorney practiced, a licensed to practice law.
Correct. All the statute requires is to be signed by one attorney. For example, we have commenced actions as local counsel for out-of-state attorneys. We frequently will list them on the summons and complaint, but not even provide a signature space, just say they're appearing of counsel, and they don't sign anything until such time as they've been admitted pro ac vice. And at that time, depending upon convenience and lots of other things, they might sign some documents, I might sign some documents, because we're now authorized to do it. But as long as one attorney licensed in the state to do it signs it. But I really don't think I can emphasize enough how the record differs from what we want and how easy it would have been under the record to have done it correctly. Ms. Fischel could have just had Mr. Weinstein sign it.
Well, under that hypothetical, though, that you just gave, you would have to satisfy yourself to the criteria under the statute was a pleading well-grounded in fact and law.
I didn't mean to suggest any of that. I just meant if there was a signature on one and another law firm appeared without any signature at all, as long as that one was by a licensed attorney, it as automatically is a representation by me that I have complied by Beadle 205, and I darn well would have.
Well, and the point of my raising that is that what the statute speaks to is not just the simple technicality of a signature, but a process, a mental process of the application of judgment to a document that's going to be filed in court making allegations, yes, of a civil wrong, not a criminal wrong, but making allegations nonetheless against somebody else of some sort of wrongdoing in a court of law, and that invokes a process, not just a technicality of signing your name to something.
And that's precisely my point about what the record shows, because the record shows little, if anything, which would substantiate that process. And without suggesting that Mr. Weinstein's being untruthful, I have no reason to doubt the truthfulness of what he actually says in the affidavit. But let's just change the situation slightly and say, instead, no one had raised this question of the propriety of the execution. And instead, the court had dismissed the case immediately, and the question was, who was going to get imposed sanctions? I'm old enough to be cynical enough to say, I'm not sure all the affidavits would say exactly the same thing. They wouldn't say untruthful things, but I'm not sure Mr. Weinstein would be jumping here to say, I drafted this, I pled it, I directed her, I authorized it, and I'm not sure Ms. Fischel would be going along with that. That's, I think, the less important policy issue here, but why do we want courts to have to even get into the position in a situation like this of judging who it is they're going to hold responsible if there's something wrong? The more important policy consideration is, don't we want to make certain lawyers treat this as, however momentary it is, however minimal the check system is, a moment where you just at least think for a second, am I doing the right thing in signing my name, which the legislature, which the rule says you have to do, and which I suspect all of us believe signing your name to something means more than something that's almost like signing your name to something.
You want us to overrule Gaddis also?
I'm not sure it's necessary to overrule Gaddis, and let me just...
There, the summons, as you recall, was not signed. It was attached to a complaint.
I don't think there's any problem with the summons as being treated differently than the complaint. They're dealt with in different statutes, and the summons statute doesn't have the provisions that Justice Sykes just referred to. So, do I think it's a good policy to allow people to file and serve unsigned summonses? No. Do I think a summons should be treated the same as a complaint? No. I think Gaddis can therefore be left as it is because it says nothing about whether a complaint has to be signed. As a matter of fact, the decision goes out of its way to point out the complaint was signed. It was just the summons that wasn't signed. The summons is just informative. That's similar to the decision in one of the other cases, which is discussed in the briefs, in which there was an error in the language of the summons. Everything was signed properly, but the direction about how the answer was to be filed, as I recall, was improper. And the question is that important? Well, the person who got it did what he or she had to do. No one was misled, and it's not something which is subject to the 80205 verification process at all. It's simply an informative document about what you need to do.
May I ask you, Mr. Johnson, 80205 refers to every pleading, motion, or other paper, and it's to be consistent. Are you saying that even one attorney from Wisconsin could not sign the name of another attorney from Wisconsin on any of these things?
That is what the statute says, first of all. Second of all, the difference is that in most of those other situations, we're not talking about something which involves the importance of filing an action. But, for example, if one could think of a witness list, for example, that had to be signed by an attorney, because I think that falls within this statute, and you filed the witness list and it had 700 names on it, which is only a slight exaggeration of some I've seen, and a lawyer didn't sign it, or he wasn't licensed in the state, I guess I'd say that hadn't been properly filed, hadn't been properly executed. If he signed it with his name, I would know he's the one who's going to answer to the court for turning in a witness list with 700 names instead of the 20 or 30 that you might expect in even a fairly complex case.
Well, in the statute, you were talking with Justice Bradley about summonses. Are not summonses papers?
They are, except there's a separate statute that deals specifically with the requirements of summonses, and that's section 801.09.
That has a signature line.
That has a signature requirement as well, but it doesn't have the other requirements, and I think because the summons has specific requirements in it, and there aren't any factual assertions in the summons. I don't think that the requirements...
Sure there are. You're notified the plaintiff named above has filed a lawsuit.
I'm sorry, what I should have said...
The complaint is attached and states the nature and basis.
It doesn't contain any allegations itself against the defendant. The complaint does.
It incorporates it by reference.
I would say it's more proper to say it refers to it. It doesn't incorporate it. It says it's attached. But I guess I'd rest primarily on the fact that the summit, and I think that's what the Gaddis Court relied on, is the fact that the summons is dealt with in a different, more specific statute. Therefore, we look to that. The same policies don't apply as they do to under 80205. If the Court has said otherwise, I wouldn't say they were wrong. I just think that's a sensible distinction.
Why can't you say when she signed the summons, it says the signature of an attorney or party, it doesn't say where it is, constitutes a certificate that the attorney or party has read the pleading motion or other paper, and that it's all blah, blah, blah. It doesn't say it has to be on the pleading.
That would then suggest that in the privacy of her office, if she wrote her name on the wall as she was sending it in, that would constitute the same thing.
I think if she did it attached so you could see it on a separate piece of paper, it would. It doesn't say it has to be signed there.
With all due respect, I think a reasonable construction of the statute is that it has to appear on the document. If
every single document.
Every single document within 80205, yes.
Okay.
Because otherwise, I guess it's the easiest, best way of knowing whether they signed it is to have it on the same document as opposed to looking elsewhere to see if we can find a signed document that might comply with this.
Well, and isn't that why the subsequent admission pro hoc vice doesn't accomplish the cure that's contemplated in the statute?
I think it doesn't accomplish it for two reasons. First of all, although there are some cases from the federal system that say that the fact that someone became admitted later takes care of the problem, I think that's either the Weldon or the Wolford case. I get those two mixed up. I don't think those cases are well-reasoned in the first place because they don't attach the minimal solemnity to the moment of the act because they're not admitted. In addition, I'll again say, Ms. Fischel didn't sign this document. She purported to sign it for Mr. Weinstein, and her name being written on it is to me no different than if she typed on the bottom, P.S., Mr. Weinstein didn't sign this, I signed it for him. All it is a handwritten notation that establishes that Mr. Weinstein didn't sign it.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Boyd?
First, Your Honor, just to respond to a comment that counsel made expressing concerns as to whether or not Mr. Weinstein and Ms. Fischel would have been prepared to come forward and take responsibility for the pleadings if it would have been dismissed sooner. The fact is it was dismissed, and the fact is both of them have always been there and are here today to take full responsibility for those pleadings. That was confirmed by Mr. Weinstein, both in his participation in the case and the fact that his name has been on the papers from the beginning, as well as his affidavit. It also was confirmed by Ms. Fischel's prompt request to be admitted within 2 weeks of filing the initial pleading and her execution of the amended summons, which I think is a paper that falls within 802.05. In fact, all of the papers that have been signed in this case fall within 802.05, and these lawyers are responsible for every single one of those papers, for reviewing them, for certifying that they are properly founded and that they are not imposed for any improper purpose.
Mr. Boyd, I don't get something here. On September 7th, your client was notified that there was problems with these documents. You had plenty of time to correct that. Why didn't they take the opportunity to correct it?
Well, again, I can only go from the record, but it's my understanding that the concern or the understanding of the concern that was raised about the papers related to the fact that there were two Robert Riegelmans working at the same firm, and I think Ms. Fischel addresses this point in her affidavit, which is at page 171 of the appendix. Upon receiving service of defendant's answer alleging ineffective service of process and becoming aware that the defendant's son, Robert Riegelman, was also an attorney employed at Riegelman and Mueckler, at the same time an amended summons with a copy of the authenticated complaint was served upon defendant in order to cure any perceived defect.
Okay, so then they did that. Then again, they're brought to notice that this amended summons just didn't cut it. And there's apparently was plenty of time still to correct it. And it was never corrected. I don't understand this kind of practice.
Well, and I cannot tell the court because I was not directly involved whether counsel understood that to be a reiteration of the very same concern or alleged defect, or whether they were on notice that there was something different. I can tell you that the record is very clear that counsel for the defendant, for the appellee, did have notice that Ms. Fischel was admitted pro hac vice, she signs the amended summons indicating that she had been admitted pro hac vice. So they, in turn, were aware of our efforts to cure, not only by filing an amended summons, but also becoming admitted pro hac vice. Whether or not they could have and should have done something in addition to that, I cannot say because I'm not as familiar with the record as perhaps I should, but they did cure it through the admission of pro hac vice. With regard to some questions about the statute of limitations, I believe that had been a disputed issue, but there is a discussion of the relevant dates in our brief at page 5 and 6, and there was some concern that we get the pleading filed before August 18, 1999 because of some board meetings that occurred 6 years earlier on August 18, 1993. So that's one reason why there was a concern to get the pleadings filed sooner rather than later. Finally, counsel referred to the Pavlik case. That's a U.S. Supreme Court case that was decided, I believe, in the late 80s, dealing with Rule 11. The advisors to Rule 11 determined that the Supreme Court was wrong in narrowly construing Rule 11. In that case, they held that law firms can't be held accountable, only the individual attorneys. The advisors revised Rule 11, consistent with the idea that those rules should be read expansively and liberally to ensure accountability, rather than allowing parties, attorneys, to hide behind some defect in a signature or something else. Given that that appellee is relying on that case, I think this court can not only look to that change in Rule 11 for the proposition that these rules should be read expansively to ensure accountability, but also to take notice of how the federal courts have applied Rule 11, consistent with that same principle, and have acknowledged that when a lawyer comes in seeking to be admitted pro hac vice and achieves that admission, that does cure any irregularity or technical defect in the signature, and that they are accountable for those pleadings that they had signed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Now, if everybody stays seated for one moment for me to make some announcements. Students will remain, and they will meet with Justice Crooks. They will be joined, perhaps, by other students. The bench will remember that we are having lunch today. And